bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
And the co-host with the most, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Gentlemen, an announcement came out last week that didn't get as much attention. And there was a detail on it also that didn't get as much focus, which I think is kind of important as far as the way things are going in technology. And that is the new iPad Pro with LiDAR on back. And for those who don't know, LiDAR is a system for detecting basically like 3D, for detecting the distances to things. And it's a little laser that scans an environment. This is what a lot of self-driving cars use. They have LiDAR built into them. And that's how they're able to navigate. Like Teslas just use cameras, but use a bunch of them to figure this out. But that LiDAR scanner is very, very interesting because what that means is effectively the new iPad Pro sees in 3D. You scan it around a room, it can see every object in the room. There are algorithms now that allow you to take those objects and to make 3D scans of stuff. You'd be able to use it to do all kinds of interesting things in 3D. And we've been talking about how Apple is really big on augmented reality. And augmented reality and placing virtual objects into the real world, one of the things you need to be able to do is to know precisely where things are in the real world to get a really good match. You want to have, you know, if you want to play a game, a chess game, you want your chessboard to sit on your coffee table and not float through it. If you want to, you know, scan around your room and have objects or characters move around and run and hide behind couches and stuff, you, again, want to know where everything is. And they've been doing a form of that. And Google had been working on this years ago with their own projects like Project Tango and all this. And this isn't just like, oh, look what Apple's doing. This is a direction everybody's moving into. But putting LiDAR on a commercial device like that was pretty significant because right now when you do augmented reality, you notice you get a little bit of shake, a little bit of that is sometimes you move the camera, move the device really fast. You're playing Pokemon Go or one of these other, you know, applications. LiDAR basically gets rid of that because LiDAR isn't using a bunch of complicated imaging algorithms to try to solve this problem.
Well,
it's using a much more simple.
Let's roll it back to the beginning. Even the way we perceive 3D is basically an algorithmic interpretation of having two cameras in the form of our eyes. And mm-hmm. we're able to get a sense of how far things away are. So the way with a single camera or multiple cameras, you're able to sort of scan with parallax. That's why with the measuring app, you have to, you know, move around. Parallax is, of course, when you're driving and the forest moves by fast, but the mountains move by very slowly. That's parallax. And the algorithm basically allows it to guess. But LiDAR, all of a sudden, there's no question how far it is. There's no guessing. It's precise. This is exactly this far away.
Well, even the iPhone, Android, they're not generally using parallax for doing that. They're using an AI estimation, basically looking at different points around in your environment and remembering these sort of things. And so it's not even as sophisticated as that, for the most part, how they're able to do it. So, like, you know, but to your point, this is a fundamental big change.
Well, and this is why there's an argument when it comes to self-driving cars, whether or not it's there are two camps of programmers that believe there are some that say you're never going to get a true self-driving car without LiDAR because the car needs to know exactly how far everything is. And then there are other people like Elon Musk who said it's a fool's errand. You're not going to be able to implement all of that with that level of precision. That's too much data. But having that option on a phone obviously opens up in this case, the iPad, opens up a level of precision that we've not seen before. But what do you think that substantively changes? I guess this just smooths over. This gives us better AR than we've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, it's the other advantage to AR too is like certain things like in rain and weather, the light gets like scattered around and stuff. But there are some solutions, right? It gets to be. Certainly, there are very much pros and cons to either side of it. But certainly for what we want to do with AR, if you can put this into consumer devices and you can reliably use it, pull out your phone and know that it's mapped your environment entirely, there's the simple stuff which we see now, which is like, you know, my joke is that like apps to figure out how your furniture fits into your living room for AR are like the 360-degree videos of skate parks and raves, you know, were for VR. It's like, okay, great. We need some other use cases for that, and we will get them. And you know, we're looking right now.
Well, first of all, just as a co-host of a series of programs that were 360 videos that featured both skate parks and raves, let me just say I bristle at your accusation, sir.
I apologize. As we saw, there was a tremendous amount of demand for that kind of content post you guys doing it. The skate park VR channel, what we just saw in the video Bryce was playing from the Apple website looked like a physical therapist aiming their iPad at a person, and the LiDAR is able to follow, track the hand. Now, you can do this with a camera, but the idea is a LiDAR, you'd be able to do it even more reliably. They're watching a guy raise his arm and measuring this range of motion, et cetera. And that's just the idea is like these things, and he's moving his arm towards the camera, as you see in a thing, which that's harder. Like you can track like in 3D, you can track kind of a 2D representation right now, like iPhones and Androids can do this where somebody moves, but to be able to move it in a three-dimensional volume to look your hand come towards you, go further away, that's trickier and less precise. So,
I mean, obviously this would probably be a bigger story if we were in a slightly more desolate news environment, but the big thing for me is that this has come down to a price that is at least consumer friendly, and obviously an iPad Pro is going to be at the top end of that kind of device, but it's not something that is fundamentally outside of consumer hardware right now, which is really exciting.
Yeah, we're looking at, we know that often like the iPad Pros, you know, whatever you see in one of those devices ends up going into every other device. So presumably we're going to see the next generation iPhone will probably have a LiDAR built into it, because now Apple's manufacturing these chips, these, you know, sensors in the millions, because Apple's long-term goal is probably going to be a form of glasses, some sort of, you know, AR spectacles, the kind of thing that we hoped Google Glass was going to be, and the whole thing that we hoped that wearables would be, but actually something that's going to have, you know, a super precise form of measuring your environment around you and interacting. Looks like this is the first big hardware step we've seen them taken.
Do you think LiDAR will have much of an effect on facial recognition, or is that a case where it's like we've already pretty much figured that the game out and there's not much more that I would imagine that the 3D mapping would maybe speed up the precision or something, as you know, you're at a party, you could pretend to be taking a photo, but really what you're doing is you're remembering everyone's name and getting a cue on that.
Yeah, I keep
that is the most Brian Brushwood
number one
Brian
thing.
Look, example of all time.
Not gonna lie. Yeah. Look, hey man, you knowed I was a Brian Brushwood when you picked me up.
I mean, yeah. To be fair, I certainly have gone through plenty of parties where there's just a lot of hey buddies and great to see you, man.
Yeah.
I absolutely, because think about the way image recognition algorithms work right now. Is they're based on taking 2D photos. And part of the problem we've had with algorithms having a bias towards, you know, maybe people who are fair skinned, whatever, part of it has to do with it's easier to sort of pick up some of the features when your skin complexions are more contrasty, like, you know, with fair skinned people, based upon just kind of, in some ways it has, part of it has to do with the sets of data sets they use, but part of it has to do just the way the algorithms work. But when you're doing 3D, when you're measuring, you know, how far your nose is from your cheekbones, all these other sorts of points, then it can become more effective. That's why, you know, the scanner that you have on the front of your iPhone, which puts all those points, that gives you, it's sort of kind of like a pseudo LiDAR. And right. That gives you a lot of 3D volumetric points. So yeah, it will improve object recognition, facial recognition tremendously once you're able to incorporate this.
So the way it does it, that's projecting like an IR grid on your face and then using the IR camera to sort of get a sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it's projecting, you know, like 100,000 dot points all over your face and then looking at, you know, the ratio, the difference between them and creating a map of that, where this is measuring like time of flight between like how long it takes a photon to make it back to the camera, which gives you much more precise distance, et cetera. But Face ID, once you go a step beyond just trying to recognize the image, and Face ID does volumetric. And I showed you the demo before where you use the the system behind that, and it creates that 3D map of your face as you move your, and you can move your face around without even turning your head.
Yeah, it was crazy. You just held up the phone, and all of a sudden everything was projected out in 3D.
Yeah. And LiDAR is going to do that. You know, LiDAR will give that even more so, is that you're going to stand in one spot in your living room, and you're going to have a 3D map of, you know, it'll be more like a relief map because you won't know what's behind stuff. But there are algorithms now that are really good at figuring stuff out. Like I used one the other day for like AI in painting, you know, where you cover up something and you want to paint it in. Photoshop is good, but there is actually AI algorithms. Like I had a thing of like this image of this underground library with this woman in the corner, and I'm like, I want to get rid of her. And so I uploaded it. If you look up like AI in painting, AI like photo touching, you'll see a couple of these. And I painted out the woman and then put it through the algorithm. And she was standing in the corner where there was like a counter went one way, a counter went another way. There was a wall, whatever. It painted her in and filled in the data of the counters and everything like that. It looked amazing. It wasn't just sort of like a blurry match the nearest neighbor kind of stuff.
Well, and there's sort of a two-way street, because there's first how good the algorithms are at sort of guessing what's back there. But then there's also the fact that you don't even have to get it right. You just have to get it good enough that it fools our monkey brains. And then so there's sort of wiggle room on both sides.
Yeah, this would be – I looked at this. I said, this is really cool, because one is – you could take that algorithm that I looked at, and again, like, again, this is just an online thing anybody can play with. I could have like had an object thing that would remove her. Like if you use, I think we talked about before, like Unscreen, which is the new app that like removes backgrounds without needing to be green screen or blue screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could take that and you could pop your person out, and then you could use this AI in painting, and you could make a 3D film from this very easily. You know, so there's just very, very cool tech. And I guess what's coming into just the idea that with that chip being put into consumer devices, we're not a far ways away from every device having these. And we start taking 3D photos and 3D maps and capturing scenes and not just photos.
Where do you think this puts the timeline for the Apple glasses? Like, so I think we all agree that's where it's going. That seems like the most Apple play of you know, like, all right, we're gonna sit on AR. I mean, obviously they've had it in all their phones and iPads and stuff like that, but we really want to like give you the new OS that you're gonna deal with for the next decade.
I would imagine when
do you think this is?
I would imagine the biggest restriction is just on how good the fashion side of things, but also just how much of the display you're able to see on there. Like, what's the closest thing we've seen? Because, you know, we've had various levels of enthusiasm for like Magic Leap or whatever the Microsoft one was, but ultimately it was just a box of a box, just this tiny, no peripheral vision experience. And what we want is sort of this full immersive level thing, and I think that's, we haven't seen any tech that really gets us where we want there.
Well, that's going to take and I think that's exactly it. And I think that what we're going to need is we'd have to sit down and look at like what is the state of the art of those projection systems. And if you read the patents that Apple's been applying for this, they're doing a couple of interesting things. One is they've applied for patents for versions of this that don't use mirrors, because they say if you move your head around, the mirrors give a little bit of vibration. And maybe they found a way around it, because they patent a lot of stuff that may be problematic. Turns out it's not. They've been patenting a lot of stuff like on that. They want to make sure that the images that are in front of you are very crisp and real and not ghost-like. They want you to feel like this is a real tangible thing. They just got a patent for the idea that when you pull out your iPhone in front of the camera, in front of your eyeglasses, you'll see your iPhone display. Even if you're looking at virtual content, it'll basically virtualize your iPhone display. So, because they're looking at probably the iPhone to be the way you control it. You put on your glasses, you pull out your iPhone, and if you need to do it, you know, touch something, it'll be a virtual display layered on top of your iPhone, which is kind of an interesting thing. I think the two things come down to are, like you said, the quality of the projection system to make sure that you get a much wider field of view, because that's been the biggest disappointment. You watch the demos for HoloLens and Magic Leap, like, oh my God, this looks cool. And then you find out that it's this little postage stamp thing, and if you move your head slightly, it falls out of frame and it destroys the illusion. Immediately, you're like, this isn't a real object. I'm just looking at kind of a magic trick. Wider field of view, and making it compact, you know, Magic Leap finally released, and the glasses were really big, and they had this sort of puck size thing that attached to it, where Apple's looking at like making this thing, they're trying to make it probably talk to your phone. And so have your phone do a lot of the processing, but then that's a lot of back and forth between your phone and the glasses. So,
although we are seeing that level of streaming, you know, we've got virtual consoles that you're able to essentially just have a stream of the video content sent to you, and the lag is small enough that you're able to do actually play action games. It doesn't seem impossible.
It's not impossible. It's just, but remember with VR, as you know, the latency, you know, what you may not appreciate so much in a console game. You know, when you go to a slight latency with between your head moving and something in a camera that's or a video thing that's attached to your eye, that can be nausea inducing. So, I mean, yeah, these are, and it might be, hey, you know, solve the lightning cable attached to it or something like that. You know, it could be, or, you know, just using a faster bandwidth thing. These are solvable, absolutely solvable problems. And it's the miniaturization of this is how do you put that projector into glasses? How do you put this new camera in there? How do you battery power it and keep it, you know, efficient? So it was easier to sort of predict where like where standalone VR was going to come out, because you just looked at cell phone display resolutions and the chips that were giant. What was Qualcomm saying they're going to come out within 12 months? Here, because you're using like this little AR, we knew there were little consumer AR chips coming out. We didn't know when somebody was going to have them. And for the video projector they're going to use, that's going to be a custom Apple thing. That's probably going to be their own design thing, and who knows.
So next year after that, 5 years from now?
Oh, I think we're a good 2 years away. Well, not from an announcement. I think we could be a year away from an announcement. But again, that seems to me, Apple in general does not tend to be a innovation leader, insofar as what they tend to do is do stuff that we've already seen pioneer edge technologies tried out and done poorly, and then they tend to come in and do stuff right. You know, even the iPhone was a bunch of existing things all blended together beautifully. The Apple Watch, there were a number of smartwatches that came out before. I don't know that I could point to many outliers or edge cases of first generation eyeglasses that are anywhere near of the level I would expect from Apple. But I don't know. Maybe that's me.
Well, sometimes the thing that takes is often it's the thing you kind of go like, oh, okay, I guess that's a thing. And then you realize how the big of a deal it was. Like with the iPhone, the thing that really made the difference was, and in retrospect, we go, oh, well, that was easy. And we go, but no, it wasn't, was multi-touch. Was really figuring out, you know, how do you interact with this? How on a mobile processor, how do you handle touches? How do you handle all that? Which we take so much for granted. And that was the thing that, and there were other people that thought like touch multiple things. It's like, yes, I want to build an electric airplane too. Great. Where is it?
Well,
you know, that's, you know, one of my favorite things to point out, but if you go back and watch the initial Steve Jobs announcement of the iPhone, one of the biggest sustained applauses is when he flicks the menu and it just rolls like, you know, in the way that we now know, like is standard on smartphone stuff. But we were so in like a push button world, or like if it did scroll, it needed a physical wheel, like. There was nothing like just like, and there we go, as if it were just a dial of options. So there's a lot there. I guess the question is exactly where I think this is a viable product if they have solved for the display. Like that's the big key. If it looks like Apple graphics are showing up and functionally, it's basically what Google Glass was or what an Apple Watch is now, where it's like primarily just showing you different little things that are popping up. If they look good, which, you know, some of the at least the patent pictures look like fashionable sort of specs. Oh, wait, here. Do we actually want to play the...
Man, I'm sitting here. I'm looking at this demo. Like, I forgot just how tiny the original iPhone was. It is so tiny. Artists,
songs, videos, and more. I'm an artist right now. Well, how do I scroll through my list of artists? How do I do this? I just take my finger...
How do I scroll?
And I scroll.
People are acting like it's the most amazing thing.
Isn't that cool? Get a little rubber banding up when I run off the edge. And if I want to pick somebody, let's say I want to pick the Beatles, I just tap them.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I would argue Apple is probably the most innovative company. I mean, if you, because they're like, oh, they use polish. If they don't innovate, nobody innovates, because I can take everything you've seen from Google or Samsung. Like,
sure, sure, sure. What I mean is usually their products come out. There are precursors to them that you could point to.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, that's true of everything. But like the example I gave was with the iPad was that Microsoft had the tablet and had this, and Apple knew, well, to have a thing really works is you need to have the battery power. You need to have the screen that lasts several hours. You know, you need to have these things sort of last. And Apple put a point on and said, okay, this is when it will work. But again, it was like the thing that made it all magic was the multi-touch. And they got a ton of patents on multi-touch because multi-touch was so innovative. But it's one of the most important innovations, the one people go like, that was obvious. It's like people, it wasn't, or people didn't know how to solve the problem.
No, I, you
know? Well, so. And I think that part of it is, I do think that so much of the experience is dependent on having, you know, the alerts look realistic, the alerts look rich and colorful, and like they're just popping into your field of view. Because there was other stuff. I mean, I haven't really screwed around with HoloLens much, but there's certainly, you know, the general idea of Google Glass, despite the fact that it was a bad product, a very half-baked product, you know, there was value in having those alerts pop up in my face compared to looking at my watch. You know, like I enjoy the fact that I get these alerts on my watch now, but man, a lot of them would be easier if I could just kind of dismiss them through a field of view.
Are you guys aware of the first like VR AR headset, the Sword of Damocles?
The what?
No.
Oh, look up, type in VR Sword of Damocles. Okay. And this was from like 1966.
Oh my gosh.
And you're looking at this. The Telesphere mask patented in like 1960. So 60-year-old concept. And what this is this guy has this, you want to describe what we're looking at?
I mean, it's imagine a vector graphics overlaid in AR. Holy crap. I'll be damned if it's not actually working. It's just a square that he's sort of walking around, but it looks like he's got, two lightsabers with mirrors bouncing the blades into his eyes. And he's got an electrical tether running above him as he's looking around in circles and mapped over the analog video tape is
he's looking
digital
at a cube.
Projection. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Pokemon Go 60 years ago.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So it's all the hardware is being suspended from the ceiling, but he's actually looking at cubes and stuff projected into his environment. It's an augmented reality headset, you know, from 1966.
Wow.
And you see there's the deck computer in there. They're able to do is that cube, that line form cube, which is basically just changing the vertices as he moves around. But, you know, you would have played with this in 1966 and probably thought that maybe 10, 20 years from now, we're all going to have portable AR devices or something.
At least some kind of AR devices. And in the chat, they're comparing it to a heads-up display, which I think is a really good comparison. You know, in some ways, I bet that this is doing a similar kind of, I guess all AR displays, even the Magic Leap is using some form of basically a Pepper's Ghost illusion, even to this day.
Yeah. They call it different names and waveguides and stuff. And I think if we call it John Crook's illusion or whatever it was. But yeah, you know, it's basically the same thing as your
you got an
reflecting
image
light off of, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's neat. I mean, this is a thing people don't talk about. If you read the Wikipedia on there, as I have in front of me, you'll talk about like alleged predecessors, like Bell Helicopters apparently was working on some sort of pilot controlled night vision thing, all these other kind of little concepts and things like this. But, you know, it's what I say. It's hard to say, like, you know, well, where did it start? It's like, well, you know, people would have neat ideas for a long time and improving on it over and over and over. But putting hardware into a consumer device, I think, is a big step, a very big step.
I'll tell you what I think is a good idea.
Yeah. God damn it. I was going to say, you want to know what I, what's a big step for you if you're not a subscriber to our Patreon, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go right now. In all honesty, guys, thank you. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who remains a patron. And we cherish every thin dime that comes in from your support, especially in these trying times. So we greatly appreciate it. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Got a custom RSS feed, and the show comes to you early as well as after things at patreon.com/weirdthings.
So another technology thing, and this was just sort of a minor news thing, but I thought it was kind of a one. There are things that just sort of slowly developed in the background, and we don't. One day they're sort of there, and I keep thinking about that with drones, like how. I remember like one day I woke up and like, oh yeah, we have these electric quadcopters that can fly around and are really precise. And I'm like, wait, when did that happen? Where was I? And how the, now they're there. But you know, there are little incremental developments along the way. And one of the things that we keep talking about is quantum computing. And you know, quantum computing again is the idea of using quantum, the properties of quantum physics to do computation, which means that you can get far more processing power than you can out of conventional, you know, using this quantum spin of a particle, et cetera. You know, there are much better explainers on YouTube that I'm going to mumble my way through. So I recommend you check that out. But the thing is, you know, it's a very big thing, you know, quantum computing, as you're trying to, you know, the world we live in where we have new challenges and things like that, where we want better computer modeling and ability to understand what's going around in the world with you and make predictions and stuff. Quantum computing is immense, and we've been using this in medical research, things like this, looking at like people who have chronic disease conditions and stuff, putting in the DNA of this thing into, you know, supercomputers right now and trying to say what are possible treatments. Quantum computing has the potential to increase that dramatically. But the problem with quantum computing is that normally you have to keep your particles like super cooled in this very this cryogenic state, which makes for very complicated hardware. If you look at a quantum computer, it looks like a nuclear reactor or something. It's very, very, you know, sophisticated. There's been a push towards developing room temperature qubits, basically having these particles that you do the computations with and being able to keep them room temperature, which would dramatically lower the cost of operating these things to make them simpler. So Science Alert has a cool article just about another development towards room temperature qubits, which, it just... another process of which they've gone into, but that's a thing to think about is the idea that, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years ago, I don't know when, you may buy a computer that has a quantum processor.
Now, am I right? Every time I hear about advancements in quantum computing, I think about the end result of it breaks all encryptions by being so massively parallel, like, and I don't know that maybe I'm taking a sideways on this, but is it obviously there by being massively parallel, there's all kinds of things that everything from, you know, running simulations of health or whatever, but I can't help but think about like breaking all encryption. Mm-hmm. It just sort of terrifies me. Like the moment that's out, that truly is the Pandora's box. There's no such thing as secrecy ever.
Well, yes, but you need to get a sufficiently, like, if the algorithms we're using right now for encryption are extremely long. Mm-hmm. And we're not anywhere close yet with where quantum computers are going to be able to break that. But then you get into quantum encryption, you know, and we will probably have quantum encryption before we have quantum computers breaking things. And we're going to come up with, you know, way more delightfully and surprising ways, I think, to protect stuff. So, yes.
And I think Brian, to your point, there will probably be an overlapping period of months, if not years, where for lagger of consumers, they will not have what they should have, and there will be rapscallions with machines that can pillage.
I'm sure there are always going to be people who use bad prediction. It's going to be more like state actors. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea okay. that you're, you know, it'll be, you know, the Chinese or U.S. national super, you know, quantum supercomputing cluster, which can crack your iPhone. You know, and that's the thing. It's like, it's going to be a huge thing before, you know, by the time it gets to the desktop. But yeah, there will always be people using weak passwords, weak stuff. That's always going to be a vulnerability for sure. And we're going to have to, you know, I think I talked about, I think that a future tech and a future service is you take you take kind of like what FaceTime or what 1Password does, and you extrapolate that into the future. The idea of, I have this secure channel, I trust this provider. I literally went to an Apple store, bought the device. This was pre-installed. I trust this thing. Or I went to the website, it was verified, their certs were real, and I installed this on my phone to handle my passwords. And we might get into that passwordless, in the end of it, where you don't use a password. We just basically, you know, we ensure the line of communication and the line of that, you know, instead, you know, because it's not so much the individual data you're trying to protect, it's the conduit.
It's interesting because it's almost like we're going back to a 19th century era with, you know, the old school version of blockchain was your personal reputation. If you vouched for somebody who vouched for somebody who vouched for somebody and had a letter of writ with a seal from so-and-so, then in general, you could accept that this well-dressed man from Sheboygan was in fact here to install your new typesetting machine. In a weird way, now that everything from deepfakes to being able to manufacture what sounds like legitimate phone calls to Photoshop and so on, we're already in a place where we no longer believe the evidence. And now we're back to kind of the 1800s, you didn't believe photographs, but you did believe written accounts of things. And by the 1900s, it was the reverse. And now I feel like we're going to some kind of blockchain future of that, where we're going to go back to believing the blockchain of who knows who saw what happen.
Yeah, and I've seen privately been shown demos of stuff that's like, I'm all bets are off. I'm in the point right now where I'm like, you know, the things people say can happen, they're happening faster than we realize, and you know. It's an exciting future.
Especially if you're a novelist who wants to write a techno horror movie.
Well, you're a novelist who says, man, my days of being able to be competitive are over, are soon to come to an end. You know, the thing that I think that makes me unique and special are not going to be unique and special so much longer.
Oh, interesting. You're saying you're already seeing the tendrils of the beginnings of robots writing novels better than humans.
Or forms of entertainment that are so, you know, that, you know, I think there's always going to be a place for human written books and book people who write books. But I'm going to tell you what's going to be, you know, we're going to see a big shift now is that, you know, given where things are going right now, gaming and things like this are going to probably displace movies into some degree, even more so. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to see a lot more probably serialized sort of content on stuff, but the big event, I'm going to go watch The One Thing by itself, is still going to exist, but rare. And I think that we're going to watch some forms of entertainment displace other ones. So I think, yeah, on one front, like, yeah, I think robots could be writing books in not too far future, but there also could be other forms of written text that will, you know, become, you know, just displace, you know. And I give you, this is tangentially related, but I read this in a book and it was a very interesting thing, which was, you know, we talked about this a little before, reading where you sit there quietly and you read into your head is a new thing. Aristotle never did that. Socrates never did that. That even probably Shakespeare, maybe probably didn't, and maybe to some degree, that is some of the greatest intellectuals in history never did that. They never sat quietly and read, you orated out loud. You read a thing aloud. That was the way in which things were processed. The idea of quiet reading as the way in which you process stuff is a relatively new invention. Words are old, and we can go back to, you know, different ancient civilizations and found how they were using symbols and things like this to represent stuff. But the idea of this narrative storytelling or communicating where you sit there and the thing gets processed inside your head is a new thing. And that means that also as a new thing, it doesn't mean it's a permanent thing either.
Yeah, that is wild. Like even the idea that you know, we of course know that you know, Shakespeare wrote in iambic pentameter. You know, he was writing with the purpose of these words being spoken aloud, and it shapes the way you express things. Whereas compare that to, you know, a stream of consciousness or the way Nietzsche is just trying to put thoughts directly onto the page. Very, very different.
But I'll tell you, the thing is that the thing about iambic pentameter. And the way, you know, your classic poems and your classic epics and stuff were written and what we do today, what you have to step back and you realize one of the things we're doing is the chunking of information. So we use sentences and we use paragraphs. Those are not, you know, they've been around for, you know, 500 years, whatever. It's still that paragraphs are sort of that idea of that paragraph. You look at older books or older, like, written letters and stuff. There were no paragraphs. It was just completely thing. You had to do a shift within there. Iambic pentameter and the other forms of which we would used to do, we'd orate. The reason you had rhyming was to make it easier to remember. It was its own error correction.
It was a checksum, you know, basically. Like you couldn't, it was hard to break it. Like, you knew it just sounded wrong, even if you were conveying the same thought. So it prevented that drift that we see when, you know, every time you remember something, you remember the corrupted last time you remembered it.
Exactly. And we use paragraphs to sort of, here's a thought, here's a thought, here's a thought, here's a thought. We use sentences, like, the rules of grammar, the ones that make sense, are very clear. This is how you communicate this information. Oh, you know, you can't have two subjects here, because all of a sudden it's very much like programming. And so, but these things, I guess the sort of larger point is that all these things, nothing is written in stone, the way these things evolve and whatever. In a shorter term, you know, I see there's a pressure, there's a competition from a lot of other things, as is the way of the world. You know, I'm not like, woe is me, woe is the writer, you know, but yeah, scary, cool, amazing.
Those are all things that I hope I'll be saying about my preemptive pick. Scary, cool, and amazing. Dude, I got a pick that I haven't even played yet, but I've already picked it, and I'm very excited about it, and it comes out today. Has to do with our conversations about ARVR, the whole shooting match. I can't wait to play Half-Life Alyx on Steam VR. If you're familiar with the Half-Life universe, this tells the tale of Alyx Vance. This takes place before the events of Half-Life 2. And it seems to be a fusion of, like, a hacking puzzle solver, but also horror game stuff coming at you. So imagine you're taking a moment to shoot a bunch of zombie figures shambling towards you, and then you lean back, and then you do a little bit of keep talking and nobody explodes, and then you lean back over and lay down some more cover fire. It's got fantastic voice talents, including Rhys Darby, who was Murray in Flight of the Conchords, and also he was in Voltron and some other good stuff in What We Do in the Shadows as well. Anyway, very, very excited about it. The review seems to be fairly positive, and it's a good time if you want to stay indoors and scare yourself. It's even more effective than Google News.
Yeah, I've heard the horror elements are really a really prominent part of this.
Yeah, people have said that they've smashed their their face masks trying to get the head crabs off of them as they leap forward on them.
This seems to be getting the buzz of, like, the first true kind of, like, AAA level game for that genre. That there have been, the most successful VR games up till now have been like very well designed, repeatable tasks, right? Like, you're playing a certain, like Beat Saber and stuff like that. Like, these are a task that, and you can, like, do a bunch of different ways. This seems far more like something that, you know, really not a lot of people have been able to crack, which is a more traditional, straight ahead, here's a story with a bunch of graphics, and we're going to lead you down this plot. But I'm so heartened to see that the reviews are great for it so far.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, because I assume that there'll be a lot of folks like you, Justin, who never played any of the previous Half-Life anythings, who will kind of be coming in new to the universe and the lore. I forget the name of the town, like Section 17 or something, like, I forget what it is, but it's a very 1984 dystopian environment that felt very progressive and surprising and fresh when it came out 20 years ago. But I wonder how they'll keep it alive in this environment.
Yeah, the stuff looks really, really good. Hey, I got a pick. It's on Netflix. It's called Tiger King. We are, I think, 3 episodes in now. But boy, every once in a while, you just get one of those documentaries that brings you into a world with very, very, very interesting people. And the world of people who buy and breed big exotic cats is certainly one of those. You might be familiar with one of the main characters is Joe Exotic, who is somebody that, like, is kind of viral video famous. But the world that these people exist in is fascinating and terrifying. And I'll just put it this way. I'm halfway through, and the most normal person in the documentary is somebody who got arrested for felony drug possession.
Ha! Wait, they're like walking cartoon characters?
I almost don't want to go into it, because each level that you peel back is just its own delight. All I will say is this, is that the stuff that just comes casually out of these people's mouths are just remarkable. It's one of those situations where, like, that they got a ton of footage. Apparently, at least for Joe Exotic, you have a ton of different. He's been recording himself in digital video forever, and so that you just have a ton of coverage for everything. And these guys are like just really open. They just really like talking. They all have internet presences. There is a lady for whom you might have a certain degree of sympathy for that. Then, boy, howdy, does she have a backstory? it's remarkable. I would encourage everybody to check it out.
All right, Tiger King.
You know, I had a magician friend that had our buddy Rand that had the cougar. And, yeah, you know, through that, the White Mountain Lion, you know, you'd meet other people who had wild cats. And that is, yeah, that is certainly what I saw of that world was interesting. He had the cat he had before that. The story of how he got it was he had a friend that was in like Miami-Dade Police Department. Years ago, Rand wanted to get where Rand had no wild cats and he wanted one for his magic act. And his buddy gives him a call. His buddy's Miami-Dade police officer. Hey, you're looking for like wild cat, like a mountain lion or something. Rand goes, yes. Yeah. I got one for you. We did a seizure on a drug dealer, and we found this thing down by the port where we found a tiger, a cat cub, chained to an engine block.
Oh my God!
Rand went down there, found this little mountain lion cub that had been chained in. Some drug dealer wanted this thing, and then got arrested. And they're like, "What do we do with this?" Like, I know a guy. So yeah, Rand gets his, you know, his drug dealer cat.
Wow! You know,
first of a couple different cats he had. And I had a friend who used to work as a costumer for Siegfried and Roy, and he knew different cat people and stuff. And I would hear like you know, like, oh yeah, this woman, you know, she was raising a lion, and then it bit her breast off. Like, holy crap! I'm like,
there apparently takes a very special personality that is like one part big-hearted empath, one part cold-eyed drug dealer. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of overhead. There's a lot of interesting decisions apparently that are made about how that goes. The breeding is where the money is, yet they all run these private zoos. There's obviously people for the ethical treatment of animals gets involved. There are other independent organizations that are fighting within them, and yet it is far more like drug cartels warring than it is like a bunch of people having a disagreement over where the laws are.
Wow. I knew a guy, his family, they raised tigers, and they had the mama tiger had a tiger cub, and those are very valuable, right? It's super valuable. And came home one day and goes to check in and opens up the window and sees that the window had been like opened, and there was like a leg hanging out, and like just a leg. A neighbor decided he was going to go into the house and take the cub.
Oh.
What he didn't realize was, because he could look through the window, he could see the cub. What he didn't realize, there was a perch above the windowsill where mama was. Guy climbs in, goes to get the cub. Mama, that ain't happening, and gets.
That's a wrap.
There's a lot of things about human 21st century life that a cat probably don't understand, but trying to steal my baby is fairly obvious and universal.
I'll say this. We're three episodes in, and though I am sure there are people that have mentioned accidents with the animals, that's like 1% of the screwed up stuff that is being discussed. Like it is every element of sex, drugs, and violence. It is all there in Tiger King. Please go check it
out. Yeah. Holy cow. The thing too, is like, just a side note is, people who raise these animals will not tell you about the time that they clawed them or did something to them because it's reputation. And there was a famous person who, which we all know, if you ever saw this person's back, riddled with claws.
Yeah.
You know, but the image they wanted to project was, you know, they love me. They would never harm me. They do all the time.
I mean, yeah, there's that element. And then, you know, just to break off one little piece, the money's in the breeding. If you let them get too big, then they become a check, you know? So there are some of these, nobody knows where some of these cubs go. There are the ones that get sold, and then who knows? I am so delighted that you guys have not seen it, because I am almost positive that I will be talking to all of you on text message over the next week as you make your way through Tiger
King. I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that this is a solo Brian adventure. There's no need to drag Bonnie in on this.
There are a lot of magicians involved in this. As it turns out, there are elements where it's like you can see that, and obviously Siegfried and Roy, you know, big box illusion magic is certainly something that, especially as a lot of these guys got their start in the 70s, 80s, you know, that I'm sure was a huge part of that business. That's who they're selling to. They are involved in it. It's something where you could watch it with Bonnie. The kids, it might be a little graphic, but I think Bonnie would appreciate some of the cast of characters that are there.
Is it me? Every single wildcat handler I have ever met all fits the same sort of physical profile, like short, very stocky, squat, you know, kind of thing. You know, not a lot of tall, reedy ones, or you know.
Yeah. All right. So, they primarily have interviewed three people that run their own private sanctuaries. One is Joe Exotic, who's a walking cartoon character, but there's another that is more of a spiritual guy, and then there's one who is running the big cat animal sanctuary, where she's trying to shut these other guys down. But she is also running her own private area where, you know, the cats she saves are on display, right? They all have one thing in common: cheap human labor. And they all do it in different ways. The charity gets a lot of people that would otherwise, animal lovers that would otherwise probably volunteer for PETA or something like that. The spiritual guy is running, you know, a more heightened and enlightened situation where you're going to learn yoga, and everybody eats, you know, vegetarian, and there's, you know, so now you're being brought in on a more spiritual level. Joe Exotic literally just picks people up. If he notices that people have been at the bus station for longer than a day and haven't left, then he goes and says, "Hey, would you like $150 a week?" And so these guys take these jobs because they're out of jail, a lot of them. They have burnt all their bridges in life. And now he just is this island of misfit toys where they, you know, they have a steady gig and they're happy for it. And nobody judges them because they've all basically been in and out of prison.
Wow.
But it's... It goes from there.
Brian, you have a compound. Have you thought about this as a staffing solution?
if you think I don't already have a tiger for a producer, then you have not met the real Bryce Castillo.
I got a pick.
What you got?
So I've also been watching stuff in these times, and I have found there's so much good TV out there, right? That sometimes you just need some bad TV. So, what I have been currently binging is NBC's Manifest on Hulu. Do you guys know Manifest?
In this, like, somebody, there's too many people on the plane or not enough people, something.
Almost. So this is NBC wanting to do a Law and Order version of Lost. So people on a plane coming back from Jamaica. There's this big family, and they say, oh, we overbooked the flight, so have some people go to this other flight. Well, the other flight, flight 828, gets this like crazy extreme turbulence on the way back from Jamaica. And when they land, they took off in 2013, and when they land, it's 2018. And so, you know, all of the everyone on the plane, but especially the three people in the big family.
The big reveal is that they discovered nobody wants Lost style mysteries anymore. That's what's changed.
Well, that's the Law and Order element of it. See, every week is like, you have to have a full story. So every week something happens and finishes.
What must that be like?
It's great. No, I love it. And so there's all sorts of mystery boxes and like, oh, but does this happen to other people? Oh, and they also have superpowers. Also, sorry, they get special voices in their head. They tell them to save the day. So Manifest, an extremely easy to watch show on Hulu.
Man, remember the event?
Oh,
that
sure.
Was the other, yeah. The other airplane, like, we need an event like Lost. Event. An airplane. Done. And now we get Manifest.
Yeah.
I feel like Manifest, my only relationship with Manifest is, like, during Sunday night football, somebody is always mystified with a flashlight. There's just a lot of, like, surprised faces slowly turning with a flashlight. Manifest.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, you got it. No, you got it. But I just, you know, you're not going to get confused too much about what's going on or you know, they have the recaps every week. It's a fine, fun actiony show, Manifest.
That's good, because, you know, those CW shows are too smart for me, and I'm looking for something I won't get confused watching. Arrow? He's a guy, not an arrow. Duh. my pick is, I picked this before, is the Oculus Quest. If you're looking for an easy way to get into VR and something that's got a lot of games and stuff that's fun, is the Quest. And what's cool about the Quest is, let's say you get this, and you're like, ah, man, this is really cool, but I want to play some of those bigger, more sexy games. Now the Quest has a thing called the Link, which if you have a gaming PC, you can actually plug your Quest into your PC and use it as with, you know, have your PC drive the Quest and get better graphics and all that and play, you know, games that are available for the Oculus Rift. So that's kind of the cool thing, is sort of the backwards or the upgradability of it now, I think, is a really cool feature.
That's
and,
cool.
They keep... Yeah, and if you're looking at which version to get, like, they have, like, the $400 and, like, the $500. Get the $400 one, because the $400 one is, it plays all the same games. It's just the amount of storage space you have on it, but with cloud storage, like, you know, if the $100 is a difference to you, just get the $400. Don't even worry about it. Hmm. There's a lot of cool content for there, and I've enjoyed it, had a lot of fun with it, and, you know, it's a good sort of first step into VR. You know, if you're looking for something simple and less expensive and you just want a different way to kill time, the Oculus Go, you can get those for like $150. And what's nice about them is you can strap a little movie theater to your head. And there's some fun little games for the Go. It's not the true like VR where you move your head around, you turn around and things move, but it's not like you duck or you can walk around an environment, but it is a 3D environment. And the Oculus Go, I've actually spent a lot of time playing with my Go sometimes. You know, I'll just like sit in bed, whatever, and watch a movie late at night. You know, so the Go is cool too. So,
interesting.
That's my pick.
Nice.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Yeah! The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.